Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning for another installment of madness as we yet again find ourselves with a sensational Delphi update since the arrest of 50-year-old Richard Allen for the murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German. This time, we actually have the affidavit of probable cause, or at least a redacted version, giving the public its first insight into how Allen ended up on the suspect list, as well as some details about what led to his arrest. Now, I was going to conclude the examination into the Long Island serial killer this week with a full episode, but with all due respect, that case is basically the equivalent of Al Capone's vault. The premise is really interesting, and the lead-up to opening the door is suspenseful, but once inside, the case is mostly an empty room. I did 2 full days of research on the case for an upcoming episode, and afterward, I couldn't think of one thing to talk about because the substance just isn't there. The Shannon Gilbert angle is very intriguing and worthy of analysis, but beyond that gateway to finding the bodies, I don't have anything to analyze. In all honesty, it's a case that the police seemingly don't want to solve, and for various reasons, from keeping their own shady dealings secret to simply denying they have a serial killer on the loose. It is, and has always been, an uphill battle to get law enforcement to care about sex workers, especially in affluent places like Suffolk County, Long Island. I don't feel a genuine effort has been made to solve the case, and don't believe there will be one moving forward. As soon as they discovered the first 4 bodies, they immediately shut down the search in a situation in which they obviously would have found many more bodies in the next day or so. Instead, they used the weather as a reason to halt the search, even though the cold weather search they were conducting at the time had been very effective, even undeniably so. There are many suspects in the case, from Joseph Brewer, who hired Shannon Gilbert the night she disappeared, to Dr. Peter Katz, who made the eerie calls to her mother Mary, claiming Shannon was at his wayward home for girls. Former police chief Jimmy Burke was also suspected by some in the public eye and has often been named as someone possibly linked to a conspiracy of law enforcement officials involved in such crimes against sex workers like they were part of a cult or produced snuff films. One man even claims Jimmy Burke approached him about a snuff film, referencing a video in which a man having sex with a woman from behind blows her brains out with a gun. And there's a lot more there. But throughout, as it goes with the rest of the suspects, there isn't anything that actually ties Burke to the deaths of those found along Ocean Parkway. In recent years, the suspect who has received the most hype, though he is not a sensational choice like law enforcement, is a man named John Bitroff. Now, the interesting thing is that Bitroff has not in any way been connected to the Lisk case, but the circumstantial aspects of the suspicion surrounding him paint a fairly common portrait of a serial killer. In the early to mid-1990s, John Bitroff, a Suffolk County, Long Island man, killed 2 women on separate occasions named Rita Tangredi and Elaine McNamee. Like the Lisk victims, they were dumped close to the road in a situation in which it seemed the driver had simply pulled over and dumped the bodies quickly before another car would come by. Both women had apparently been posed with at least 1 arm above their heads. Now, that was 1993 and 1994, respectively, a time in which, unless you were following criminal technology closely, you might not have known about DNA testing. The 1995 O.J. Simpson trial was the first sensational trial in the public eye in which DNA played a major role. So, if you had killed 2 women in 1993 and 1994, you might have been ignorant, back at that time, in relation to DNA. And, clearly, John Bitroff was. While he covered his tracks otherwise, DNA testing from both the Tangredi and McNamee cases led to a genealogical DNA match in 2014. Of course, it was only a partial match, and the DNA in the system ended up belonging to Bitroff's brother, allowing them to locate John as the perpetrator. Now, the first Lisk killing, unofficially, happened in 1996, placing Bitroff's need to alter his MO to cater to technology right after his previous murders chronologically, a time in which it's likely he, like most people interested in criminal investigations, learned about DNA. The Lisk crimes seem to have gone from 1996 to perhaps 2011, though that is certainly up for debate as we don't truly know the answer. That would put Bitroff in his mid-20s at the start and early 40s at the end. He was 44 years old at the time of his arrest in 2014. Now, why do some believe it's him? Well, he fits the profile well. He targets sex workers, lives in the area, dumps victims on the side of the road where they can be easily found, and has a specific interest in the limbs after death occurs. First it was posing, and then it was dismemberment, but thematically, they're both speaking to the same idea of control delivered through a conduit of shock value. Posing, or dismemberment, are intended to induce shock, meaning the person finding the body sees the physical horror and says, "I can't believe someone would do this. Who would do something this awful? And why?" And what the killer is trying to elicit in a manifested way is understanding and compassion by bringing the discovering party into their emotional life from the past and showing them, in images, what was done to them. Danny Rowling, the Gainesville Ripper who inspired the killer from Scream, was violently assaulted by his father as a child in their home, and so he would murder and torture people as an adult before posing them so that others could come home into that place and experience the unexpected shock of what had been done to the victim, with the victim, of course, being a projected manifestation of the killer's past childhood. When they show you what happened to the victim, physically they're trying to tell you what happened to them emotionally. So a man who was brutalized in his youth by a parent would likely be looking up at that person and trying to stop the blows. So quite often when bodies are posed, we find one of the arms above the head. But since you can't put a dead person's arm straight up like it's defending something or reaching for help, this act of putting the arm above the head and behind it to prop it up using the shoulder is often mistaken for simply twisting the body like a pretzel to cause shock. However, the shock value intended is always utilized by the killer to tell the truth about what happened to him emotionally inside that place to cause his emotional death. Anyhow, John Bitroff, like I said, was a carpenter from Manorville. Now, he's a killer and even has a job in which he would be constantly cutting wood with saws, something which is a similar idea to dismembering limbs. During the Lisk killings, while parts of two women were found at Gilgo Beach, their torsos were both discovered in Manorville, where John Bitroff lived at the time. One of those torsos was even discovered lying on top of a heap of scrap wood. Bitroff was described as a married man with two sons, and like many serial killers, when he was caught, the he would never complex was strong. His neighbors and others described him as a very helpful and friendly person, with one neighbor even describing him like being the mayor of their town. Of course, none of that means anything. It's a joke. That's who a lot of serial killers are. Your friendly neighbor who cares about his children and pets your dog on his way out to work with his lunch pail in the morning. Bitroff fits the psychological profile. age range and familial considerations common to many white male serial killers. His ability to escape capture for many years also speaks to a meticulous person who, upon learning about DNA, would alter an MO to accommodate technology. If you're making me guess, and we're doing it under the assumption Lisk is one person, my money is on John Bitroff, yet not because of any definitive evidence, rather, he's simply the best fit from the suspect pool. Could Lisk be somebody else, even a cop? Absolutely. But again, if we're talking known suspects, I think from both physical and psychological standpoints, John Bitroff is the guy. We know for a fact he is this type of killer, as he's been caught for it, and his association to dismemberment, or chopping things into pieces, specifically doing it through the conduit of carpentry, while two torsos were found in his hometown during this time, is enough for me. At least, enough to speculate that he is Lisk. But what's really interesting, even though I could not prove it was true, is that many sources suggest John Bitroff built Gus Coletti's garage. If you recall, Gus Coletti was the neighbor who was awake shaving at 5 a.m. when Shannon Gilbert started banging on his door and asking for help. Is it possible that, even though Bitroff would have known about that area previously, that working there gave him a close-up look at exactly how isolated it really was? Was he inspired to dump bodies there moving forward? We don't know. When it comes to the other known suspects, most of them have no prior connection to any crimes consistent with the Lisk killings. Bitroff, on the other hand, has been convicted of two similar murders. Unless some type of hard evidence comes forth in relation to guys like Brewer, Burke, or Katz, this is the one guy who not only has a past consistent with such killings, but also lived where the two torsos were found. In addition to that, while there is no concrete connection between these two things, it is interesting to mention that supposedly Melissa Bartholomew, a Lisk victim, was the best friend of the daughter of John Bitroff's victim, Rita Tangredi. Is that just a coincidence? It could be. Moreover, there's an obvious element of hunting apparent in these murders, one perhaps more consistent with hunting animals such as deer, as the parts of these people were first dismembered and then, according to the police, wrapped. That's often what occurs when butchering or dressing hunted animals, and it's done in preparation for consumption and, even more so, for storage. Of course, most killers don't cannibalize their victims. What they are saying is that they have been consumed emotionally by their internal problems, and since you can't see them and they don't have the courage to talk about them, they tell you with pictures. Of course, the body can't be consumed because then it wouldn't be there for the message to be sent. So the killer prepares the quote-unquote meat by butchering it and wrapping it, leaving the next phase of consumption one that happens emotionally through realization of the truth. Something was consuming the perpetrator emotionally and tearing him apart, to the point he died inside. So we receive the manifested physicality of that idea mirrored back at us with the victim to allow comprehension of the killer's suffering. This behavior manifests in killers who are emotionally stunted man-children because, as a child, when you get hurt, you go to authority figures and show them your pain, which allows them enough understanding and also breeds enough concern for them to follow up by asking, "What happened?" Those of you who are parents know that a small cut on a male child's kneecap can turn into a five-act Shakespearean production. sometimes they don't even bother to cry until you've seen the cut. They get hurt, and instead of attending to the injury, as the priority would call for, the first thing they do is try to show it to mom and dad to get a reaction. The idea is that they want someone to make the pain go away. They want someone to heal that wound. So as much as you might apply a band-aid, the emotional support you provide that person's injured psyche becomes equally important. And it's because we want to be understood for how we hurt, how we suffer. And those trips to mom and dad to show them the bloody kneecap at 5 years old are the earliest explorations of that idea. You're trying to say, I need people to know how I hurt, and I'm going to show them. And of course, in physicality, it's much easier. If you show somebody a kneecap, just like you show them a bloody body, then there is going to be a reaction, and there is no necessity for an emotional transfer within. The child, upon showing the bloody kneecap, does not have to say, I've been cut, right? Just like the killer showing the dead body does not have to say, I've been hurt inside, because the mirrored version of that is that the victim has been hurt on the outside. Now, you can run to mommy when you're 5, but when you're 35, the world is a different place. If you're still doing that when you're a grown man physically, it is very likely that the cops have replaced your mommy. That's why we call the sociopath a man-child. Here he is in a man's body, unleashing his powerful physical wrath in the form of death. Yet it's done in the vein of a small child who can't bring himself to articulate what's wrong because he doesn't have the emotional maturity. All of you who are parents know those moments when your kids are suffering something and want you to know but won't tell you, and it becomes something where you have to guess until you get it right. We all want to be understood for our pain, and the man-child can't do it because what he suffered in his youth is irreconcilable in terms of relief when placed against his unwillingness to talk about it. He behaves like the monster version of the small child who will only tell you what's wrong by showing you physically, yet since those acts are illegal, he has to hide. Again, every parent listening knows the moment when your small child does something bad and then runs off and hides, waiting for you to find them and introduce the punishment. No, they don't want to be punished, but if you finally see them for what they've suffered through their bad deeds, they accept that result as fulfillment of their desires, because what will happen is that the authority figure, or law enforcement, aka the parent, understands. And most of these killings stem from childhood abuse of some sort at the hands of a male parental figure. Perhaps the greatest adversity we face in life on an emotional level is how to tell people who we really are in the absence of words being sufficient to complete the task. We are told to go out into the world and quote-unquote show them who you really are, yet in the context of not having to say it. That's what we're all trying to do, and it's hard. The serial killer is no different. Lisk is saying, I've been torn apart emotionally and can't be put back together again. The inability to become whole again is the inability to become the father. Our universal evolutionary plight goes from unity to disunity back to unity, or becoming whole once again. So in a familial context, it's the father giving way to the son, who is then quote-unquote ripped apart as he matures to become the father. You're tearing up the blueprint for the child in order to reassemble it as the blueprint for the father. failing to transcend that role as the son, by way of abuse leading to stunted emotional growth, is the basis for most serial killings. The body grows and moves on into adulthood. The mind stays in the home in which it was abused and does so in the context of being a child. So because that grown man's body shows no sign of the child that once was, yet that child still lives inside him, he uses the victims as a human canvas upon which to tell us about himself through emotional projections. And it's done through a conduit of sexuality, meaning someone who can be, quote-unquote, the mother, and usually a young woman, ends up as his victim as he plays the role of the father. By killing the mother, you symbolically preclude the child's existence. For lack of a better term, it's an emotional abortion. Of course, if you were a gay man, you would simply kill men instead and proceed to do the same, as we see with guys like Dahmer and Gacy. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you ever find yourself feeling stuck? Recently, I had a problem I'd been going over and over in my head, yet couldn't seem to find a solution. And then it hit me. Life comes with so many questions and uncertainties, but rarely offers an equivalent amount of answers. It makes me wish life came with a user manual. Thankfully, BetterHelp online therapy is basically the next best thing. They can assist in navigating the various challenges life throws at us, from relationships to parenting or even a career change. We all have different needs, from learning coping skills to dealing with trauma, and in my experience, therapy is helpful. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/CCMM. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/CCMM. Anyhow, let's switch gears into the Delphi murders update now. I had recently discussed the arrest of Richard Allen, and suddenly, once we'd been told the affidavit of probable cause had been sealed, it was seemingly unsealed, or it was leaked, whatever the case might be. So, while we, as the public, certainly don't have a clear and complete picture of the landscape moving forward in this case, the recently released info definitely helps to inform our perspective in a factual way, something we'd been missing almost entirely to this point. So let's begin by reading the affidavit of probable cause in its entirety. It's just a few pages, and then afterward, we'll examine what's between the lines, as well as speculate about what might not appear in this document in terms of other or additional evidence linking Richard Allen, or even others, to the murders. There has been speculation that other parties were involved, but they aren't mentioned in this document, so let's take a look at that consideration too. Okay, so this is the probable cause affidavit. I, the undersigned affiant, submit the following information pursuant to IC-35-33-7-2 as a sworn affidavit setting forth the facts and circumstances known to law enforcement of Carroll County as the basis for probable cause to arrest without a warrant or establish probable cause for issue of an arrest warrant for the above-named defendant, Richard M. Allen, that the facts and circumstances described below would be sufficient basis for a person of reasonable caution and prudence to believe that the accused has committed or attempted to commit the offenses described, and that if arrested without a warrant, such would be authorized under IC 35-33-1-1. That the hearsay statements of witnesses contained herein are considered reliable and credible due to the witness's personal knowledge and or are corroborated by the totality of the circumstances. That on February 14, 2017, Victim 1 and Victim 2 were found deceased in the woods approximately 0.2 miles northeast of the Monon High Bridge in Carroll County. Their bodies were located on the north side of the Deer Creek. At the time, the Monon High Bridge Trail was an approximately 1 mile gravel trail terminating at the Monon High Bridge. The Monon High Bridge is an abandoned railroad trestle approximately 0.25 miles long, spanning the Deer Creek and Deer Creek Valley on the southeast end of the trail. Approximately 0.7 miles northwest on the trail from the northwestern edge of the Monon High Bridge is the Freedom Bridge, which is a pedestrian bridge spanning State Road 25. Approximately 350 feet west of Freedom Bridge was a former railroad overpass over Old State Road 25, also known as County Road 300 North. The trail terminates just west of the former railroad overpass. The majority of the trail is in a wooded area with a steep embankment on the south side of the trail. The entirety of the trail and the location of the girls' bodies were and are located in Carroll County, Indiana. Through interviews, reviews of electronic records, and review of video at the Hoosier Harvest Store, investigators believe Victim 1 and Victim 2 were dropped off across from the Mears Farm at 1:49 p.m. on February 13, 2017, by Redacted. The Mears Farm is located on the north side of County Road 300 North, near an entrance to the trails. A video from Victim 2's phone shows that at 2:13 p.m., Victim 1 and Victim 2 encountered a male subject on the southeast portion of the Monon High Bridge. The male ordered the girls, quote-unquote, guys down the hill. No witnesses saw them after this time. No outgoing communications were found on Victim 2's phone after this time. Their bodies were discovered on February 14, 2017. The video recovered from Victim 2's phone shows Victim 1 walking southeast on the Monon High Bridge while a male subject wearing a dark jacket and jeans walks behind her. As the male subject approaches Victim 1 and Victim 2, one of the victim mentions, quote-unquote, gun. Near the end of the video, a male is seen and heard telling the girls, quote-unquote, guys down the hill. The girls then proceed down the hill, and the video ends. A still photograph taken from the video and the guys down the hill audio was subsequently released to the public to assist investigators in identifying the male. Victim 1 and Victim 2's deaths were ruled as homicides. Clothes were found in the Deer Creek belonging to Victim 1 and Victim 2, south of where their bodies were located. There was also a .40 caliber unspent round less than 2 feet away from Victim 2's body, between Victim 1 and Victim 2's bodies. The round was unspent and had extraction marks on it. Interviews were conducted with three juveniles, Redacted and Redacted. They advised they were on the Monon High Bridge Trail on February 13, 2017. They advised they were walking on the trail toward Freedom Bridge to go home when they encountered a male walking from Freedom Bridge toward the Monon High Bridge. Redacted described the male as quote-unquote kind of creepy and advised he was wearing quote-unquote, like blue jeans, a like really light blue jacket, and his hair was gray, maybe a little brown, and he did not really show his face. She advised the jacket was a duck canvas type jacket. Redacted advised she said hi to the male, but he just glared at them. She recalled him being in all black and had something covering his mouth. She described him as quote-unquote not very tall with a bigger build. She said he was not bigger than 5 feet 10 inches. Redacted advised he was wearing a black hoodie, black jeans, and black boots. She stated he had his hands in his pockets. Redacted showed investigators photographs she took on her phone while she was on the trail that day. The photographs included a photo of the Monon High Bridge taken at 12:43 p.m. and another one taken at 1:26 p.m. of the bench east of the Freedom Bridge. Redacted advised after she took the photo of the bench, they started walking back toward Freedom Bridge. She advised that was when they encountered the man who matched the description of the photograph taken from Victim 2's video. Redacted described the man she encountered on the trail as wearing a blue or black windbreaker jacket. She advised the jacket had a collar and he had his hood up from the clothing underneath his jacket. She advised he was wearing baggy jeans and was taller than her. She advised her head came up to approximately his shoulder. She advised that she said hi to the man and that he said nothing back. She stated he was walking with a purpose, like he knew where he was going. She stated he had his hands in his pockets and kept his head down. She advised she did not get a good look at his face, but believed him to be a white male. The girls advised after encountering the male, they continued their walk across Freedom Bridge and the old railroad bridge over Old State Road 25. Investigators spoke with Redacted, who advised she was on the trails on February 13, 2017. Video from the Hoosier Harvest Store captured Redacted's vehicle traveling eastbound at 1:46 p.m. toward the entrance across from the Mears Farm. Redacted advised she saw 4 juvenile females walking on the bridge over Old State Road 25 as she was driving underneath on her way to park. Redacted advised there were no other cars parked across from the Mears Farm when she parked. She advised she walked to the Monon High Bridge and observed a male matching the one from Victim 2's video. She described the male she saw as a white male wearing blue jeans and a blue jean jacket. She advised he was standing on the first platform of the Monon High Bridge, approximately 50 feet from her. She advised she turned around at the bridge and continued her walk. She advised approximately halfway between the bridge and the parking area across from Mears Farm, she passed 2 girls walking toward Monon High Bridge. She advised she believed the girls were Victim 1 and Victim 2. Video from the Hoosier Harvest Store shows at 1:49 p.m., a white car matching Redacted's vehicle traveling away from the entrance across from the Mears Farm. Redacted advised she finished her walk and saw no other adults other than the male on the bridge. Her vehicle is seen on Hoosier Harvest Store video at 2:14 p.m. leaving westbound from the trails. Redacted advised when she was leaving, she noted a vehicle was parked in an odd manner at the old Child Protective Services building. She said it was not odd for vehicles to be parked there, but she noticed it was odd because of the manner it was parked, backed in near the building. Investigators received a tip from Redacted in which he stated he was on his way to Delphi on State Road 25 around 2:10 p.m. on February 13, 2017. He observed a purple PT Cruiser or a small SUV-type vehicle parked on the south side of the old CPS building. He stated it appeared as though it was backed in as to conceal the license plate of the vehicle. redacted both drew diagrams of where they saw the vehicle parked, and their diagrams generally matched as to the area the vehicle was parked and the manner in which it was parked. Redacted advised he remembered seeing a smaller dark-colored car parked at the old CPS building. He described it as possibly being a smart car. Redacted's vehicle is seen leaving at 2:28 p.m. on the Hoosier Harvester video. Investigators spoke with Redacted, who stated that she was traveling east on 300 North on February 13, 2022, which is, I'm just going to pause here for a second and say that is obviously a typo. The 2022 part is supposed to be 2017. Anyway, continuing, and observed a male subject walking west on the north side of 300 North away from the Monon High Bridge. Redacted advised that the male subject was wearing a blue-colored jacket and blue jeans and was muddy and bloody. She further stated that it appeared he had gotten into a fight. Investigators were able to determine from watching the video from the Hoosier Harvester that Redacted was traveling on CR 300 North at approximately 3:57 p.m., through interviews, electronic data, photographs, and video from the Hoosier Harvester, investigators determined that there were other people on the trail that day after 2:13 p.m. Those people were interviewed, and none of those individuals encountered the male subject referenced above, witnessed by the juvenile girls, Redacted and Redacted. Further, none of those individuals witnessed Victim 1 and Victim 2. Investigators reviewing prior tips encountered a tip narrative from an officer who interviewed Richard Allen in 2017. That narrative stated, Mr. Allen was on the trail between 1330 hours and 1530 hours, which of course would be the hours of 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. He parked at the old Farm Bureau building and walked to the new Freedom Bridge. While at the Freedom Bridge, he saw three females. He noted one was taller and had brown or black hair. He did not remember description, nor did he speak with them. He walked from the Freedom Bridge to the High Bridge, meaning the Monon High Bridge. He did not see anybody, although he stated he was watching a stock ticker on his phone as he walked. He stated there were vehicles parked at the High Bridge trail ahead. However, he did not pay attention to them. He did not take any photos or video. His cell phone did not list an IMEI, but did have the following. And I'm not going to read these codes because they don't really mean anything to us, but investigators believe Mr. Allen was referring to the former Child Protective Services building, as there was not a Farm Bureau building in the area, nor had there been. Investigators believe the females he saw included Redacted and Redacted due to the time they were leaving the trail, the time he reported getting to the trail, and the descriptions the three females gave. Investigators discovered Richard Allen owned two vehicles in 2017, a 2016 black Ford Focus and a 2006 gray Ford 500. Investigators observed a vehicle that resembled Allen's 2016 Ford Focus on the Hoosier Harvester video at 1:27 p.m., traveling westbound on CR 300 North in front of the Hoosier Harvester, which coincided with his statement that he arrived around 1:30 p.m. at the trails. Investigators note witnesses described the vehicle parked at the former Child Protective Services building as a PT Cruiser, small SUV, or smart car. Investigators believe those descriptions are similar in nature to a 2016 Ford Focus. On October 13th, 2022, Richard Allen was interviewed again by investigators. He advised he was on the trails on February 13th, 2017. He stated he saw juvenile girls on the trails east of Freedom Bridge and that he went on to the Monon High Bridge. Richard Allen further stated he went out onto the Monon High Bridge to watch the fish. Later in his statement, he said he walked out to the first platform on the bridge. He stated he then walked back, sat on a bench on the trail, and then left. He stated he parked his car on the side of an old building. He told investigators that he was wearing blue jeans and a blue or black Carhartt jacket with a hood. He advised he may have been wearing some type of head covering as well. He further claimed he saw no one else except for the juvenile girls he saw east of the Freedom Bridge. He told investigators that he owns firearms and they are at his home. Richard M. Allen's wife, Kathy Allen, also spoke to investigators. She confirmed that Richard did have guns and knives at the residence. She also stated that Richard still owns a blue Carhartt jacket. On October 13, 2022, investigators executed a search warrant of Richard M. Allen's residence at 1967 North Whiteman Drive, Delphi, Carroll County, Indiana. Among other items, officers located jackets, boots, knives, and firearms, including a Sig Sauer Model P226 40 caliber pistol with serial number U625627. Between October 14, 2022 and October 19, 2022, the Indiana State Police Laboratory performed an analysis on Allen's Sig Sauer Model P226. The laboratory performed a physical examination and classification of the firearm, function test, barrel and overall length measurement, test firing, ammunition component characterization, microscopic comparison, and NIBIN. The laboratory determined that the unspent round located within 2 feet of victim 2's body had been cycled through Richard M. Allen's Sig Sauer Model P226. The laboratory remarked, "An identification opinion is reached when the evidence exhibits an agreement of class characteristics and a sufficient agreement of individual marks. Sufficient agreement is related to the significant duplication of random striated/impressed marks as evidenced by the correspondence of a pattern or combination of patterns of surface contours. The interpretation of identification is subjective in nature and based on relevant scientific research and the reporting examiner's training and experience." Investigators then ran the firearm and found that the firearm was purchased by Richard Allen in 2001. Richard Allen voluntarily came to the Indiana State Police Post on October 26, 2022. He spoke with investigators and stated that he never allowed anyone to use or borrow the Sig Sauer Model P226 firearm. When asked about the unspent bullet, he did not have an explanation of why the bullet was found between the bodies of Victim 1 and Victim 2. He again admitted that he was on the trail, but denied knowing Victim 1 or Victim 2 and denied any involvement in their murders. Carroll County Sheriff's Department Detective Redacted has been part of the investigation since it started in 2017. He has had an opportunity to review and examine evidence gathered in this investigation. Detective Redacted, along with other investigators, believe the evidence gathered shows that Richard Allen is the male subject seen on the video from Victim 2's phone who forced the victims down the hill. further that the victims were forced down the hill by Richard Allen and led to the location where they were murdered. Through the statements and photographs of the juvenile females and the statement of redacted and redacted, they were at the southeast edge of the trail at 12:43 p.m., east of Freedom Bridge at 1:26 p.m., and walked across the former railroad overpass over Old State Road 25 after 1:26 p.m. and before 1:46 p.m. They walked the entirety of the trail and observed only one person, an adult male. Redacted's vehicle is seen on the Hoosier Harvest Store video at 1:46 p.m. and leaving at 2:14 p.m., and she stated she only saw one adult male. Redacted and Redacted described the male in similar manners, wearing similar clothing, leading investigators to believe all four saw the same male individual. Investigators believe the male observed by Redacted and Redacted is the same male depicted in the video from Victim 2's phone due to the descriptions of the male by the four females matching the male in the video. Furthermore, Victim 2's video was taken at 2:13 p.m. and Redacted saw only one male while she was on the trail from approximately 1:46 p.m. to 2:14 p.m. Investigators believe Richard Allen was the man seen by Redacted and Redacted and the male seen in Victim 2's video. Richard Allen told investigators he was on the trail from 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. that day. Video from Hoosier Harvest Store shows a vehicle that matches the description of Richard Allen's vehicle passing at 1:27 p.m. toward the former CPS building. The clothing he told investigators he was wearing matches the clothing of the male in Victim 2's video and the clothing descriptions provided by Redacted and Redacted. A vehicle matching the description of his 2016 Ford Focus is seen at or around 2:10 p.m., 2:14 p.m., and 2:28 p.m. at the former CPS building. Through his own admissions, Richard Allen walked the trails and eventually hiked to the Monon High Bridge and walked out onto the Monon High Bridge. A male subject matching Richard Allen's description was not seen on the trail after 2:13 p.m. Investigators identified other individuals on the trails or CR 300 North between 2:30 p.m. and 4:11 p.m. None of those individuals saw a male subject matching the description of Richard Allen on the trail. Furthermore, Richard Allen stated that he only saw three girls on the trail, who investigators believed to be Redacted, Redacted, Redacted. Investigators believe Richard Allen was not seen on the trail after 2:13 p.m. because he was in the woods with Victim 1 and Victim 2. An unspent .40 caliber round between the bodies of Victim 1 and Victim 2 was forensically determined to have been cycled through Richard Allen's Sig Sauer Model P226. The Sig Sauer Model P226 was found at Richard Allen's residence and he admitted to owning it. Investigators were able to determine that he had owned it since 2001. Richard Allen stated he had not been on that property where the unspent round was found, that he did not know the property owner, and that he had no explanation as to why a round cycled through his firearm would be at that location. Furthermore, he stated that he never allowed anyone to use or borrow the Sig Sauer Model P226. Investigators believe that after the victims were murdered, Richard Allen returned to his vehicle by walking down CR 300 North. Investigators believe he was seen by Redacted walking back to his vehicle on CR 300 North with clothes that were muddy and bloody. Redacted, along with investigators, believed the statements made by the witnesses because the statements corroborate the timeline of the death of the two victims, as well as coincide with the admissions made by Richard Allen. Further, the accounts relayed by Redacted and Redacted are similar in nature, and timestamps on photographs taken by Redacted correspond to the times the juvenile females said they were on the trail and saw the male individual. Okay, so most of this is pretty straightforward and comprised of things we already know, right until we get to the point that the video is taken. We now know the video ends right after the perpetrator, armed with a gun, says down the hill. Now, we don't know if more than one firearm was utilized in the crime, but it seems at this point one of the girls says gun. The perpetrator orders them down the hill, as we already knew from the audio, so it's now apparent that the gun, in combination with that simple order, was enough to get compliance from the girls without argument or further explanation. Now, that weapon, while we can make no guarantees, is probably the Sig Sauer 40 caliber mentioned in the affidavit. So he takes them across the creek wielding that weapon, and at some point, clothing from both girls ends up in the water. Did they undress partially here, or did the killer take the clothing to the water afterward due to considerations related to washing off physical evidence? We don't know. Symbolically, when a killer takes the victims through the abyss, here being the creek, the clothing would come off as a sign of an approaching rebirth, at least, again, symbolically. You go through the abyss and come out the other side nude, free of identity, like a baby born into a new identity upon traveling the birth canal. Again, the killer uses the victim or victims as physical projections of his childhood self to accompany the child still living inside him, but within the context of his preferred sexual orientation, meaning a man will choose a younger female and not a male to symbolize him if he is indeed straight. This happens because sexuality is the specific transcendent quality that is available in a man but not in a boy. Basically, men can become the father. You kill the child inside you by bringing that child into the outside world and then climb the hill or ascend into adulthood having become whole or the father, meaning you have killed the child inside you, leaving only the man. Accordingly, the narrative the affidavit suggests is one in which Richard Allen did not go back onto the trails, but as I suggested in my episodes, went up the hill at Ron Logan's property, through the graveyard, and out onto the road, or 300 North, as referenced here. Just like the Hillside Strangler did, the idea is to leave the child at the bottom of the hill dead, or stuck in the abyss, as you remain on top, symbolically making you the father. It reverses your emotional reality of being stuck in that place psychologically since childhood, unable to climb the hill into adulthood. It puts the adult body at top and dead child at bottom, mimicking an emotional maturation process that never happened and was instead only physical. Emotionally, as we mature, we quote-unquote kill the child we are physically and emotionally through growth until finally that person is no longer recognizable and for all intents and purposes no longer exists. A crime like the Delphi murders does the same thing, yet instead of merging the physical and emotional necessity of sacrificing oneself to mature, the emotionally impotent perpetrator uses someone else strictly in physicality, and the emotional element, as it always has been with them, is ignored. It makes us ask, why? it leaves us in a place where we have to ask who did it and why, which is the most basic functionality of the concept of evolution. Who is God, and why did he make this universe in which we suffer until we lose it all and die? It's what happens to a killer's victims, and is, in essence, humanity's fate as well. Now, at the crime scene, we don't get an explanation of the cause of death, though in the past, law enforcement did admit those deaths were the result of a bladed weapon. We could assume that means a knife or something similar. Beyond that, the bombshell here is the presence of a single round that was seemingly ejected from the perpetrator's Sig Sauer. To be clear, he did not discharge the weapon. It was not fired. It was not the result of trying to shoot someone. I'm about as far as you could possibly get from being a firearms expert, but what I can do is examine circumstance here. If a single round is ejected from the weapon without firing, and in a situation in which it seems the incident occurred right at the point of the murders, my impression is that the killer racked the slide on his gun as an intimidation measure. If one were to pull that thing all the way back and do so hastily while trying to deal with two victims, it might have been to create a threat. Whether they saw it, heard it, or both, there would be no mistaking the sound of that slide racking. And what it would say is one thing, that the round, in one way or another, is being transferred, right? You're either pulling it into the gun, into the chamber, right? Or it's coming out. Now here, in some way, accidentally, it seems that Richard might have ejected this thing. So racking the slide in such a situation would likely say to the victims, "I'm getting ready to fire. You better cooperate." They would either hear or see the slide being racked and believe they were one step closer to being shot. Now, to be fair, again, this is also ironic because racking the slide is something one would often do after firing the weapon. If you wanted to insert the first round into the chamber, or conversely, eject the last round from the barrel, racking the slide could precipitate either of those activities. Again, I'm no expert, but if I had to guess, I would say racking the slide was used as an intimidation measure to induce greater fear and thus better cooperation, and since it was performed under great duress, the ejected round went unnoticed by the killer, even in his cleanup efforts to come at the scene. The round was discovered only perhaps 2 feet from Libby's body and was described as being located between the victims. That location, along with the idea that the gun wasn't the murder weapon, seems to suggest the killer was in the process of preparing to murder the victims in that spot and was then receiving the greatest degree of pushback from the victims, which required intimidation methods. Regardless, that round underwent ballistics testing, though in perhaps a bit of an unusual manner, as we'd normally be talking about a projectile that had been fired from the weapon. The markings in question, which have reportedly matched those made by Richard Allen's Sig Sauer, are a product of the round passing through the chamber and not being fired. So, in a situation in which ballistics identification is already somewhat controversial, is it possible to get a perfect match between the round discovered at the crime scene and the markings made by Allen's gun? I don't know. I'll leave that to the experts. If I had to guess, I'd say law enforcement is very confident that this will prove to be damning evidence. As far as we can see in the affidavit, it does seem to be their magic bullet. Aside from what's in the affidavit, we also have to consider ancillary evidence involving other parties, specifically issues related to how Allen communicated with Libby German, or, in lieu of that, how he acquired the information she'd be at the bridge that day. Of course, he could have gotten that info from Keegan Klein, or accessed something online in which Klein was involved, such as sharing among creeps seeking kids. There could be a direct connection, or simply a virtual commonality by visiting the same sites for creeps. If we think back to Doug Carter mentioning the potential necessity for perhaps bringing on another 80 detectives once they had their guy, it seems to speak to widespread involvement, or others being involved, in the vein of what used to be called a pedophile ring. It used to be creeps often worked together physically, but now, given the efficiency of the internet, one person's information could lead to someone they've never seen, met, or even heard of using it to harm a child. I'm sure we'll get greater clarity on that moving forward, and my guess is that while we won't have an accomplice linked to Allen at the scene of the murders, there certainly could be further charges related to other people and cases. Now, here's where Richard Allen makes some terrible mistakes. When he speaks with the police, he tells them what he needs them to believe. But the fact of the matter is that there are other witnesses on the trails, and he gives no consideration to what they will say. So if they all tell the same story, and his is the one that's different, while he fits the physical description of the perpetrator, then he has a serious problem. He has to say he never saw the girls who were killed, yet they were there. So he goes to the cops and says he was out on the trails that day, and during the hours the victims were there, but he didn't see them. He's literally asserting something that's impossible. If he was there during those hours, he would have seen them. He would have passed them. So here we have a woman parking her car by the Mears entrance where the girls entered that day. Not only does she walk to the Monon High Bridge, but she sees bridge guys standing on the platform when she arrives, meaning the first platform. Most people don't cross the bridge, as the trail just terminates after the end of the trestle. So upon seeing this man, she turns around and goes back the other way in the direction of her car. When she does, she passes Libby German and Abby Williams. Now, clearly, Allen was witnessed, and the girls were witnessed, while Allen, according to the sighting, would have crossed paths with Abby and Libby. Yet he tells the cops he never saw them, while also telling them that he was dressed like Bridge Guy. So in Allen's mind, the only thing that matters is what he says. He's not considering other witnesses. The witness just mentioned saw a man dressed both like Allen and Bridge Guy, and when combined with the notion that Allen is the only man of that description to have been on the trail that day and at that time, it says the killer could only be him. That is, unless someone else was there. But we have video of him. If that man was somebody else and we could confirm it, then we'd still have the issue of not being able to place Richard Allen on the trail in a manner in which he definitely would have come across the murder victims. His best bet would have been to say that he saw the girls. But in his mind, surely he believed that if he said he didn't see them, then it would have been impossible to kill them. He was trying to avoid admitting that he saw the girls on the trails. Yet by process of elimination, we know that if he was there at that time, he had to see them. By that same token, we also know Bridge Guy is him. He went to the police voluntarily and said he was on the trails that day, and likely to preclude them finding out later and making him look overtly suspicious for not coming forward. Yet the truth is that law enforcement only needed to fill one set of shoes out on that trail, and Richard Allen stepped right into them free of charge. They were looking for one man dressed like that, and it was Richard Allen. He handed it to them on a silver platter. So what did they do? Did they investigate further? No. They ignored the information and never bothered to follow up. they never bothered to ask Richard Allen for his gun back in 2017 when he came to them. Instead, they claim there was a clerical error leading to this oversight, something for which the FBI is reportedly responsible. Oh, please. You look at this and you're like, okay, now I completely understand why they wanted this thing sealed. I would want this thing burned if I were them. I would never want anybody to know that I was part of an oversight of that magnitude. It is unbelievable. This suspect should have been apprehended within perhaps 48 hours. They go on to tell us the car they believe was used in the crime was Allen's 2016 Ford Focus, which they have matched to a vehicle parked at the old CPS building, yet it was described by witnesses as being either a PT Cruiser or a smart car. A Focus looks nothing like a smart car or a PT Cruiser, and in fact, the PT Cruiser stopped being manufactured 7 years before the murders and 6 years before the 2016 Focus Allen owned was even built. Furthermore, Allen told them he parked at the old Farm Bureau building, and instead of pressing him when they realized there was no old Farm Bureau building, they just assumed he meant the CPS building and never stopped him to confirm. I mean, the killer tells you he parked at a place that doesn't exist and you don't press him for the actual location by refuting his assertion? You could have easily caught him in a lie. Can you imagine thinking the description of a smart car or a PT Cruiser being a Ford Focus is probable cause for arresting somebody for murder? It's insane. I can't even believe they would include that garbage. Now, ask yourself why Richard Allen would call the CPS building the old Farm Bureau building. Look for the mirror. In farming, what process do you indulge? Growth. And what is the opposite of growth in terms of process? Death. Or we could say decay leading to death, like we would say birth leading to growth. So he wants to project the idea of growth instead of death, meaning he's focusing on his manifested physical growth, like they do in farming, instead of the girl's death. So he's mirroring that idea to get the reversed value. Now, let's just do that again with the real name of the building. It's the CPS building. So, of course, whatever CPS means should be the opposite or reversed value of what Richard Allen really did. So, CPS stands for Child Protective Services. Now, we have our value, so let's get out the mirror and reverse it. If the place where you've parked is intended for Child Protective Services, then you do the opposite or mirror that, which is to do what? Hurt them. The physical reality simply projects the emotional world, which is then mirrored back at you. So when a sociopath commits a crime, we can follow the breadcrumbs. Allen, or whomever the killer was emotionally stuck in that place, not moving forward along the road of life, and likely due to abuse in his childhood. So here he is, parked outside of a place that promises to protect children, but like he's saying with the Farm Bureau reference, it's a lie. They don't protect children here. There is no growth. They actually hurt them. That's what he's trying to tell us about his past. And of course, the building is closed, yet he's still waiting outside because he's stuck in that place, aka his childhood, emotionally, his childhood home. He can't return to his childhood home and get the protection and love he never had as a kid, symbolized by the place being closed and abandoned along the road of life. Notice that after the crime, he leaves that place because the car is his vehicle, physically, in a manifested way, for getting out of there emotionally. This is the place where he's emotionally stuck, somewhere where they hurt children. As an example, and something I think I've mentioned in the past, Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys legend who suffered with mental illness, walked into a Cadillac dealership in the 1980s and handed a woman working as a salesperson on the floor a piece of paper that begged her to get him out of there because he needed help. He wasn't there to buy a car. He was suffering psychologically and saw this woman as his vehicle out of that place. So he utilized the dealership as the physical manifestation of the place from where he would leave, as it was one that could offer the idea of getting into a vehicle he had never been inside before in an attempt to escape his circumstances. And you know what? He's still with that woman. Symbolism is extremely powerful. That's why, when the police were interviewing Alan, what was most important to him was proceeding in the absence of the child. He was compelled to go to the police and, above and beyond any other consideration, tell them that he was absolutely sure that he was on the trail that day, but that the children in question were not there. He didn't see them. They had disappeared. He wants that child inside him dead, and so when he offers his eyewitness sighting, even though he would do very well to admit he saw the girls, he can't do it because it's confirmation of the child's existence. In our evolutionary narrative, God is the Father and Jesus the Son, or whatever characters you'd like to apply to that structure to suit your needs. So, for Jesus to become God, he, the son, or child, disappears. If you're religious, you might understand that as becoming the Holy Ghost, or Holy Spirit, which means crossing the transcendence point between being the flesh and blood son to becoming the disembodied or deified father. That's why a killer disappears into anonymity after the crime. It mimics what Jesus would do through the process of becoming God. And like we ask, who is God and why did he make this world? We do the same for the killer. We ask first, who did it? And then follow up with asking, why? And of course, women dominate true crime audiences, and by a very large margin, because this matter is of the greatest importance, simply because if the son of flesh and blood Jesus is extracted in the evolutionary narrative, then by default of no longer needing the womb, so is the mother. That leads to extraction of gender as we move from being binary to non-binary and reproductive to replicative, using AI to facilitate the earliest phase of the human transition to becoming biologically immortal. Men, by default, are also then extracted as well, as they no longer are necessary to accommodate the reproductive needs absent the womb. What results is the movement or evolution of a binary world involving collisions of oppositional values giving way to a singularity or deity, something called God. So here, our victims are both female and children to symbolize the necessary extraction prior to climbing the hill to deification. Alan is desperate to go to the cops and tell them that he saw no children because, by default of that, it means there are no women either, and therefore the only entity left, the mysterious one whose identity is unknown at the top of the hill, is the father. That's the most powerful place you can put yourself symbolically, and so that is what the killer is going to do. A guy who does this is one who was abused by his father or even both parents. I don't know if we'll ever learn anything about Richard Allen's background, but I would be willing to bet abuse played a prominent role in it. I think what's most damaging to good old Rick here is that he was not only allegedly witnessed walking along 300 North, muddy and bloody, but that nobody reported seeing a man of his description on the trails after 2:13 p.m., which was the time of the video in which we see that the victims were accosted. So where was Rick during that time? Probably killing the girls. But we'll see. Hopefully, the trial will fill in the blanks where we, as the public, still remain ignorant. Finally, I think the one thing that captures my attention the most is this assertion by Rick that he went to the Monon High Bridge to watch the fish. Think about that. When you go fishing, What are you trying to do? Catch something, right? And what do you use to do that? If it's artificial, you call it a lure. If it's live, you call it bait. Think about those terms. Bait, lure, catch. That's what fishermen do. They deceive the fish by baiting and luring them into a circumstance in which they get caught and can't escape their predator. Yet even though that bridge is well known for fishing, look what Alan tells us. He was just watching the fish. So he's saying he didn't lure them. He didn't bait them. He didn't catch them. And so he didn't kill them. He was just there to observe them moving around freely. And look where he is. He's above the bridge. He is the father looking down into the abyss. And so those fish represent the children. They are in the place of change. So he's saying he wasn't there to kill the fish. He was just there to observe them moving around freely. What does that say he wanted? He wanted that child down in the abyss of his mind to finally set him free. And the only way to do that, unfortunately, is for the child to die. But if you can't kill the child emotionally, you have to project it onto somebody physically and murder that victim. Anyhow, let's leave off there for now, and hopefully we'll have another update in the case soon, one that's a step closer to justice for the families, the loved ones, and of course, the victims.